Yves Ray requested me to talk about tensor network randomization. And he said, at least half an hour you have to talk about tensor network randomization and real space Hamiltonian flows, and then the other half an hour I will talk about something that is related to it that I wanted to talk about. So, outline. It will be very, very general. So the first half an hour will be really very, very general because I think Giffrey would be a much better person to talk about this. But anyway, so I will talk about real space normalization and somehow just review the very some very old ideas and also kind of explain the way I understand somehow the new ways in which like this TRG and TNR and MERA kind of fit in this framework. And then I will also kind of talk about some recent work that we did in my group, mainly Matthias Ball, which is a PhD student, where we looked at this TNR but tried to alleviate somehow some of the shortcomings in TNR, namely that somehow in this whole tensor network normalization group, you start, let's say, in a two-dimensional classical critical system, you're interested in fixed points, but using these normal TRG or TNR approaches, what you do is basically map your tensor networks, which starts as being the partition function of a classical Hamiltonian system, to some partition function that has lots of negative and positive coefficients, and therefore does not really have a meaning anymore in terms of a Hamiltonian. Because, of course, if you have like a classical stat-mech system, the tensor network that is represented by it should kind of only have positive or at least non-negative coefficients. And so what we did is actually just in some sense an exercise, trying to see whether indeed the whole kind of TNR construction still survives if you additionally impose that everything remains positive. And in such a way that indeed you get kind of, you can really somehow interpret these schemes or this kind of tensor network normalization schemes as Hamiltonian flows to fixed points as originally envisioned by Wilson and Kadanov and these people. So I will talk about this. And then in the second part of the talk, I will make the claim that actually it's very important if you do such kind of real space normalization group, things like TNR, but also the other approaches using matrix product states or PEPs or MERA, that it's very important to take into account somehow the symmetries to get accurate results. And it turns out that matrix product operator algebras give an extremely convenient way of give very explicit representations of somehow the symmetries that arise in such theories, and especially somehow the additional symmetries that occur at criticality, and it's exactly these symmetries, of course, that give rise to the whole richness of the CFTs. That's why I wanted to talk about this, because this fits very well within the topic of this conference. Okay, so what about real space normalization? So the original ideas date back to Kadanov, Fischer, Wilson, I think all back to the 60s when somehow people were studying critical phenomena in classical statistical mechanical settings. So the archetypical model is like the classical Ising model where you have or any kind of model with classical spins. So you have like a lattice, and on every kind of, let's say, edge you have a certain number of spins. You have a spin, like in the case of Ising, it's a two-dimensional, it can be spin up or spin down, and then you have some Hamiltonian terms that connect these spins on the different edges, or of course you can also define these spins on being on the vertices, it doesn't really matter. And then you sum up basically all possible ways in which you can combine this, somehow all the possible configurations, that's the partition function, and that gives rise to the free energy. And what you're interested in is typically the thermodynamic, or that's at least what these people were interested in, but it's still, this is the most important proper information, is of course there's the thermodynamics, the infrared physics, specific heat, magnetization, critical exponents. How can you understand this? How can you kind of make sense of all these kind of different kind of things, and especially what happens at criticality? Well, what are the kind of length scales, and how do you kind of deal with this? And the amazing insight of Wilson is that indeed somehow you can get a humongous amount of understanding of actually what physics is about by exactly asking this question of how you can deal with such systems, and especially how you can define renormalized Hamiltonians, or somehow when you kind of define some kind of randomization group flow on Hamiltonian. I'm sure all of you are very much aware of this, so I will not really kind of talk too much about this, but somehow the idea is that indeed you have a family of Hamiltonians. Okay, you have like two-point correlation also, but also three 3-point interactions, 4-point, and maybe 5-point. And what you do is integrate out spins and try to kind of the new kind of renormalized model you also want to write down in the same kind of way, but somehow this coefficient C of alpha will kind of be changed. Okay, so the C of alpha prime after one randomization will kind of be functions of the old coefficients, and fixed points are obtained basically whenever somehow this C prime is equal to the C. Okay, and this is then a fixed point Hamiltonian and critical exponents and eigenvalues can be obtained by calculating eigenvalues of this matrix, somehow basically this function that relates somehow coefficients from the different RG steps with each other. Okay, so I had to basically look up what the first successes were of this method in real space. And actually it's very early on, of course, somehow the most successful application of this real space RG, in which you indeed take this Hamiltonian and kind of integrate out a few spins and try again to approximate this with another Hamiltonian of the same kind, was actually done for the Ising model on the triangular lattice by Niemeyer and von Leeuwen in 73. And they used somehow the Ising kind of model on the triangular lattice. And why is the triangular lattice so kind of useful? It's because indeed if you kind of renormalize spins, so what you do is basically combine all the spins on this, so the spins are on the vertices here, and somehow you will combine all the spins in one plaquette here. So this shaded plaquette, you will count these three spins will become one spin in the renormalized version. And somehow, because you have three spins, there's a very kind of clear way of doing some majority voting. Okay, and again, somehow you kind of renormalize this, you kind of do majority voting here, you get again a triangular lattice. And they did this in a very kind of extensive way and kind of looked at what are the terms that we have to keep in the Hamiltonian. And I saw that actually by keeping pretty not too many terms, somehow you need the nearest neighbor, then three body, four body, and so further. And at some point, somehow, you kind of keep on doing that and then exactly apply this formula that we had before, where you have this function that applies something to the previous one. They do some simple combinatorics and see that indeed they are able to kind of approximate the critical exponents and an amazing, to an amazing precision. Somehow this is like, well, this showed you this is indeed the right idea. This kind of seems to work very well. So nevertheless, somehow, despite that somehow you had that somehow the success of these simple models And several more sophistications, especially by people like Kadanov, that worked a lot on these real space RG kind of transformations. These blocking methods have never kind of really worked in a systematic, in a black box way. You always had to kind of do lots of things by hand, and it was not entirely clear what this why or what the limitations are of this this thing. And the way I understand somehow the fact that indeed this has to kind of fail, this real space RG, where you kind of take spins and kind of renormalize these spins in a block and then couple them to another renormalized block, has actually to do with somehow the mutual information catastrophe. So the fact is that if you have a classical statistical mechanical model and somehow you divide your system into two pieces, like an A and you have kind of B, and you're interested in somehow quantifying the correlations that you have between region A and region B, what you can see, it's actually a very easy calculation somehow using somehow the variational characterization of Gibbs states, is that indeed somehow the mutual information satisfies an area law. Okay, so that means that the total number of correlations between A and B is something that scales like linearly in the size of your blocks. So if you now somehow do this real space RG a la Kalanov and you start renormalizing somehow all the spins in this block, and also somehow the spins in this block outside, but of course it's just functions of the spins inside and outside. You don't really kind of do anything in between. Somehow to be faithful, you really have to keep on capturing this mutual information. And that means that you really have to kind of get longer and longer kind of interactions such that somehow this mutual information kind of would kind of be preserved. So total number of correlations will be preserved. Okay, and so that's kind of for me the reason that indeed this approach is kind of the naive approach, where you just renormalize spins. You take a few spins, renormalize those together to a new one in this block A and completely independently in B. This can never work. Okay, and this has to do with the fact that indeed there's some kind of an area law going on. So you cannot deal with somehow the bipartite entanglement between A and B. There's too many correlations, and if you want to do this good, you'll have to kind of increase and increase, and there's no way you will ever get somehow interesting fixed points using such an approach. So the way to overcoming this kind of mutual information obstacle is basically to change the tensor product structure. And I think this was the genius of Levin and Nave back in 2006 or 2007, in which they understood that indeed, if you want to, I'm not so sure that this is the way they understood it, but this is always the way I understood their paper, is that somehow to overcome this mutual information, or somehow this mutual information catastrophe, that somehow what you have to do is not kind of block spins and kind of renormalize these spins in itself. You have to change the tensor product structure of your lattice. Okay, so basically what you will do is take these four spins here. Okay, you take these four spins and replace them by one spin, but that one spin is not these four spins, but it's like four times a half spin. Okay, so like this spin here will kind of, half of it will go there, the half of it will go there. So you completely change the tensor product structure of your lattice. And this is the way you have to renormalize your spins. And if you do this, you can easily convince yourself that indeed you can completely overcome that mutual information obstacle. Because somehow, if you have indeed correlations, by changing the tensor product structure, these correlations can become kind of product states. And therefore, you kind of, you get a sustainable thing. So the way this works is indeed you kind of take these four spins, get one, you get these four, this one, and somehow the new lattice that you get after some kind of a renormalization step in this Levin-Nave scheme is like this. This is now a square lattice tilted over 45 degrees, and you keep on doing this, and this allows you to overcome at least this mutual information obstacle. So more precisely, the way somehow this TRG, this tensor network, this tensor normalization group works is that you start with somehow your tensor network for your classical statistical mechanical model. You use something like an SVD. That's the typical thing. You use an SVD to kind of split this thing in two possible ways. Then you look at one of these plaquettes. Indeed, somehow use somehow this and this ways in a judicious choice. You get this kind of thing. And then you see, aha, this will kind of, now I can contract these four things, and this will become my new kind of renormalized spin. So indeed, somehow this new renormalized spin kind of contains four halves of your kind of original spins. And indeed, using this construction, you overcome somehow this mutual information obstacle. And that's why this is really exciting. Okay, this is clearly somehow a huge step forward. Indeed, this is just explaining it again what I already kind of said. Somehow, if you kind of take the original cut of your entanglement, somehow the new cut doesn't really have, the old cut of your mutual information doesn't really have a meaning anymore, because somehow you split these kind of sides in the middle, and therefore that's basically the way you can overcome this. So this TRG has been successfully applied to a variety of classical stat-mech models like the POTS model, even continuous models like the XY model. And somehow it has also kind of, it's also possible to, of course, use this to evaluate expectation values of PEPs, because a PEPs is in some sense nothing more than like a classical partition function in a double layer setting. The thing works in practice is that somehow by taking the singular value decomposition, you will see that in practice somehow this bond dimension that you get here does not have to be the square of the dimensions that you had here, but somehow this can be smaller than the product. Because if you kind of do this exactly, then at every step the bond dimension would basically square at any iteration step, and of course, well, it would be exact, but somehow it would be completely impossible to do in practice. So you have to basically decimate in some way, and the way to decimate is basically say at some point I have a maximal bond dimension that I can tolerate. There's some kind of a singular value decomposition here, and I take the largest, let's say 10 or 100 values, and I kind of keep on doing this. In some sense, this is conceptually kind of beautiful, no? Because the cost to contract translation invariant tensor networks immediately becomes logarithmic now in the size of the lattice. If it's translation invariant, and by every one of these decimation steps, you basically divide, or the number of sides in the lattice kind of is halved, and therefore you can kind of do huge lattices in a very, very short time period. And you can start dreaming somehow that indeed you can actually start, because of all these transformations, you can really do very exciting things like renormalizing impurity tensors and so further, kind of do some kind of non-trivial conformal transformations. All somehow on the condition that indeed these tensors flow to some kind of a fixed point, because that would be the point, that if you would have a critical system and then somehow you would expect that all these tensors would kind of flow to some fixed points, and then somehow, well, if you have a fixed point, then you can have some kind of a scale invariant theory, and you can really kind of envision somehow lattice versions of things that you would like to do in the, or that are very well known in the continuum. But this is of course completely conditioned on the fact that you would flow to a fixed point. And it turns out that this is not true. Okay, so the TRG kind of does not flow to fixed points if a fixed number of singular values is kept. There's actually another kind of problem. So an important problem for this talk is actually that indeed this TRG, if you start with the partition function, doing this singular value decomposition, you immediately get tensor networks with negative coefficients, and there's no meaning anymore. You cannot understand anymore that tensor network after a few steps in terms of a classical statistical mechanical model, okay? Because negative kind of Boltzmann weights are not allowed, okay? This is not physical, and somehow this is certainly kind of, I think this is actually not a really big problem, but nevertheless, it's kind of nice to, it's a conceptual problem. Another kind of flow of this TRG that had been solved by somehow higher order TRG kind of transformations and all this, but nevertheless, they don't attack the core of the problem, which is this third problem, is that somehow you can, in some sense, take into account somehow, if you kind of take an SVD, also a little bit information of the environment. And typically, you do this by taking some mean field approach of the environment and so further, very much inspired by the way you do this in DMRG. Anyway, so TRG kind of has solved this bipartite entanglement problem because it allows you to overcome this mutual information kind of bound, but it has actually not solved the multipartite one. Okay, so this, it turns out that TRG is actually missing some type of correlations that maybe the entanglement or the bipartite entanglement is kind of solved with this, but not somehow the multipartite. That's at least the way I like to understand this. And this is most easily understood in terms of this kind of concept that is called double loop tensors, which I think, I'm not so sure where they appeared first, but somehow they certainly appeared or were kind of studied extensively by Chen Gu and Wen and somehow some papers that at the end led to this whole kind of classification of non-trivial bosonic SPT phases. But anyway, so what these kind of statistical mechanical models are is just kind of complete product state of loops, but on the one side, so this is one side, this is the next side, and what you have is basically G at Z state, so kind of completely, this is a one, all these things are one, and if this is a zero, they're all zero. Okay, this is like a very simple partition function that is completely local because somehow these things don't interact with each other. This loop doesn't interact with this loop. They are completely independent. And your local sites are these sites. Now, if you would apply the TRG algorithm to this kind of so-called double loop tensors, then you can see that actually this state is a fixed point of that TRG calculation, which is obviously not what you want because this state is clearly not something that is scale invariant. Okay, it only has one scale, namely that has one loop on one side, and you don't want, if you kind of do some TRG in which somehow you want to relate somehow the physics at one length scale to the physics at another length scale, that somehow this model would always give the same fixed point. Okay, this is clearly not what you should obtain. So the correlations are strictly local, but somehow nevertheless this TRG is not able to remove somehow this four-partite entanglement. Okay, this is the reason that this is not bipartite, this is really four-partite entanglement where somehow these four kind of sites are very strongly correlated with each other. And indeed somehow the fundamental problem can be traced back to the bipartite decimation step where you kind of take this tensor and then split it in these two possible ways. But by doing something like that, you cannot see that indeed somehow this loop, there's kind of local loops in your tensor that should kind of be taken out of your RG step. So Gu and Wen suggested kind of in these papers to remove such double line entanglement using filtering approaches and other things, but somehow their procedure was certainly not, as far as I understood, powerful enough to lead to fixed point tensors at criticality. Glenn and Giffre in the game, and they basically cure all the problems, okay, by basically combine this formalism of TRG with the firepower of the MERA or the multiscale entanglement realization ansatz. So what they did is indeed identify somehow or really basically guess good ways of dealing with somehow this multipartite and bipartite entanglement and kind of write down an RG kind of scheme in which you kind of block tensors to new tensors in such a way that all these kind of problems are overcome and that actually we have fixed points at criticality. If you have a critical system that somehow this kind of RG steps, if you kind of go around, always lead back to the same state. Exactly the problem that TRG somehow was not able to solve. So how do they do this? Well, they use, of course, their kind of, I think Giffre only has one trick. He always uses disentanglers, always isometries. And it works well. So what you do is try to approximate indeed somehow plaquettes by, so this is basically kind of an approximate equality. You try to introduce disentangler, or disentangler's isometry such that this plaquette is basically equal to this plaquette. How to optimize this? Well, there's very powerful algorithms to do this. But anyway, so you do this step, you kind of replace this with this because this is an approximate equality. Then you get a new lattice. Then you combine, very similar to in TRG, you split the tensor product structure now open and combine the tensors in different ways. So this is how you kind of really get this new tensor product structure. You get a new lattice, then again use some kind of, well, I'm not so sure why here they just do the TRG. They could have done exactly the same again. But anyway, so there's many possible variants of that scheme. But the beautiful thing is that somehow the way they kind of solve this is by introducing indeed somehow new ways of splitting these tensors in a multipartite way, not just somehow this bipartite splitting like Levin and Navi did. No, it really has to do with somehow the more bigger blocks. You really have to take into account somehow the four-partite kind of ways of doing this, and then somehow they get real fixed points of their disentangler. So just to, I stole all these slides. So till now I didn't say anything about my own work. So this is all work of the people of TRG, but then also kind of course of Glenn and Giffrey. So this is a picture out of their of a very nice paper of 2015 in which they indeed identify or show basically that indeed these double loop tensors using a judicious choice of disentanglers is completely solved, because somehow what you do is this, approximate this with this kind of thing where you have the disentanglers, the isometries, and then you see that indeed this inner loop, which is actually the local kind of entanglement, is completely gone. And somehow in one step, basically, all these kind of local loops are renormalized and they get immediately a product state. Okay, and so this is kind of clearly an indication of the power. So it seems to capture the bipartite, some multipartite entanglement. Is this enough? I don't know. Okay, so I think this is still not completely settled. Is it enough to do this or not? So for the examples that I have seen, it is extremely convincing that this is true. I would actually have to ask Glenn and Giffrey to what extent they believe that actually all the possible kind of entanglements or all the possible ways in which you can have correlations are captured by this. It seems to be very convincing that it's true, but I don't think there's any way you can prove this. But somehow, so it's amazing somehow the way, the improvement that they get for critical systems. So if you kind of really do this RG steps or this tensor network minimization steps for a critical system, and you compare basically the bond dimension that you needed using this TRG approach versus the bond dimension that they need, it's clear that somehow with a much lower bond dimension and also the scale, it's not about the bond dimension, but it's really about the scaling. The scaling that they have is really kind of exponential here versus this is just a polynomial scaling. And that's indeed indicating that at a fixed point somehow TRG doesn't work, but TNR really works. And they are able to kind of extract very nice magnetizations, everything. But somehow the most important point is clearly that this TNR, if you do this TNR, implement this TNR scheme, that you get actually tensors that are mapped onto themselves. That you get renormalization fixed points. And by doing this, there's actually an extremely nice, well, no, there's actually another another way of understanding somehow TRG versus TNR that Glenn and Giffrey explained. In terms of basically the way you approximate the partition function or the leading eigenvectors of your partition function. So if you have like a classical statistical mechanical model, the most important or the most relevant thing if you want to do kind of a variational ansatz or the numerics is indeed somehow how well do you approximate the eigenvectors of the transfer matrix. And if you kind of trace back what the TRG people do, somehow in which somehow you renormalize these steps, you kind of can trace, you can keep track of these disentanglers and so further. What you see is that somehow the way TRG approximates eigenvectors of transfer matrix is actually by a three-tensor network. And we know that a three-tensor network is not really kind of capturing the right physics, no? Because somehow it's clearly very non-translation invariant and so further. Now, what they showed in their paper is that the difference in some sense between TRG and TNR is that TNR gives rise to a Mera structure instead of the three tensor network. I'm not so sure that somehow whether you work backwards, that you started from this and then kind of figured out how to do TNR, or somehow that this was kind of something that you figured out afterwards, but well, you have to, or both, maybe you don't remember yourself. But anyway, it's a beautiful kind of, indeed, way of seeing that, indeed, this TNR is much more powerful than the TRG, because somehow you really capture somehow these entanglers, what kind of makes that indeed this is a very good candidate of somehow as an eigenvector of your kind of transfer matrix of critical systems. Okay, so because TNR yields fixed points, it's now also possible to realize the original dream of TRG and construct basically conformal transformations on the lattice. Okay, so this is basically what they did. So what you have this lattice now, because we have this completely scale invariant, you can start renormalizing different ways on the lattice. You can renormalize somehow only once here, but kind of many times outside. And what they see is that indeed somehow they get this radial kind of maps. They can really do conformal transformations on the lattice. And this is another kind of beautiful paper that appeared, I think, last year or 2 years ago. I'm not so sure, but anyway, so it's of course an immediate consequence. If you have a scale invariant kind of RG a la TNR or TRG, then indeed somehow it's immediate that somehow you can start playing these games and understanding basically lattice versions of conformal maps. This has no sign problem. No. Although, well, again, the sign problem that there is that these models actually don't have a meaning in terms of a classical statistical mechanical model. So even if you start with the classical Ising model or the Potts model or another model, what you get here is a tensor network that is scale invariant, but to which you cannot really associate a Hamiltonian. Okay, and this is basically the epsilon contribution that we added to this, and basically repeating this whole story, but then imposing at every step that that everything is positive, and what will come out is that actually everything works equally well as in somehow this original case. There was an alternative tensor network normalization scheme that has been proposed by Xuo, who's in the audience, I think, indeed, Gu and Wen, which has been published very recently, which, as far as I understand, yields similar results in practice and in terms of accuracy. And the main difference in doing this step, although the spirit is very, very similar. No? So once you identify the real problem, then somehow it's a very similar approach to what Giffrey and Glenn did. But somehow the main issue is to replace basically these plaquettes by a new tensor product structure. So what they do is start from this tensor product structure of these four kind of things and split up all these kind of guys into two. So you get eight sides, so you get the tensor product structure of eight tensors. And then if somehow the way you optimize from this tensor to this tensor is in such a way that somehow if there would have been some loops inside somehow this plaquette, they would be removed by this RG step. So in practice, it's all not so easy, but they were certainly able to get this to work. And somehow the main kind of technical thing is very similar to what we heard in the talk of Ashley on Tuesday, is namely basically we approximate this tensor as a matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions. Okay, and you have these algorithms for doing this, and then indeed this matrix product state is kind of able to approximate this, and then you can start playing the game. Yes. This gives rise to the mirror. I will show actually a picture later. So it's at the end it also gives rise to fixed points and to as long as you have a fixed point, you always will get the mirror if you kind of are able to get to capture somehow this multipart entanglement. So this was taken from their recently published paper. It's a very similar scheme as the previous one. So you start with your tensor, then you basically, they do some filtering, because in practice it's not so easy to get rid of these loops. But anyway, they do some filtering, then they do, not so sure what this is, but then they replace their loops with somehow these matrix product states, and this is always the key. I think this was also the key idea of TRG, and I think this is still the core of all these methods, why they work so well, is you change the tensor product structure. You split up these tensors into several tensors and then recombine in a different way, and that's what they do. They split up these tensors and recombine in a different way, and in this way they also get a kind of a loop, and indeed they are able to kind of find fixed points of this kind of, in the case of critical systems. And they get actually very similar accuracies as the works of Glenn and Giffrey. And therefore, you can start playing all the same games. Okay, the fixed points are indeed Mera and so further. Although these are not Mera anymore in terms of unitary circuits, because somehow you didn't use unitarity anymore. So the Mera that emerged out of somehow the TNR construction were really kind of unitary Meras. What you get here is a structure that is similar to the Mera, but is actually not unitary. And therefore, in some sense, less useful because you cannot contract these things very easily. Okay, but this is still somehow the introduction. Somehow there is a nice paper of Kadanov in which he basically criticized all this tensor network approaches. I'm not too sure whether it was because he didn't really understand, but he certainly had a point that this tensor network randomization schemes or this TRG schemes, it's very difficult to associate a meaning or a physical meaning to actually what does that mean in terms of this original Wilsonian idea that you have a Hamiltonian flow. Okay, so I have a certain flow, I kind of integrate out some kind of get a new Hamiltonian on a different level. What is the meaning? You get all these different parameters, you get all these kind of lots of parameters, but can you associate a meaning to this kind of thing? And this is basically, this was the starting point for our work. Yes, please.
But you could also think that these schemes of RG in real space, they are not restricted to classical statistical mechanics. And for most quantum systems, there is no possible positive weights from the beginning.
No, that's not true. Actually, for a quantum system, yes. E to the minus beta H, there would still be a notion of positivity in the semi-definite sense. So your partition function is still a positive operator. So what you have
one thing is that if you remove the sign problem, the Monte Carlo people will be very, very happy. The reason why you can
no, indeed, but somehow you even get signs for classical systems. So,
what I'm saying is that there is a wide class of problems, basically generic quantum field theories, that if you try to do RG on the Euclidean path integral, you don't have positivity from the start.
Sure, okay. But even there, what you have is actually some kind of positivity in the sense of a semi-definite sense that you would not like to lose. So even these kind of things that have a sign problem, they are positive in somehow a semi-definite sense, no? Because the density matrix is at the end a positive operator. And if you do an RG kind of simulation and on the partition function of your quantum system, you would like that at every step your density matrix is still positive. Okay, and I'm not. We didn't solve that problem, but somehow this is something that you need a semi-definite generalization. So this statement remains true in the quantum case.
I don't understand what you mean by density matrix, but I'll ask you.
No, but e to the minus beta h is like a density matrix. It's a positive operator, and if you kind of start renormalizing your tensor network without kind of imposing that
but
this kind of
density matrix is the transfer matrix of the Euclidean path integral.
No, I'm talking about the full kind of density matrix of your system, e to the minus beta h.
Yeah. That's a transfer metric. Okay.
But so this is about.
We'll get the room.
This is about the small. So. Anyway, people have not been able to kind of do anything in quantum using these approaches yet. Okay. So this is about the conceptual kind of question that I had. Can we basically merge this approach of TNR with the Hamiltonian flow? Can we associate really a flow of Hamiltonians with somehow this TNR scheme that kind of basically implements the original kind of visionary ideas of Kadanov and Wilson. And what is very clear is that somehow what is very different to this approach than to somehow the original approaches is that the tensor product structure has continuously changed. So somehow this TNR approaches, what they show is that the right way of defining Hamiltonian flows is not by blocking spins and all these kind of things, but it's by changing completely your tensor product structure and kind of keeping locality, but kind of maybe at the cost of having large dimensional spins. So even if you kind of start with the Ising model with the two-level spins, so what this TNR teaches us is that if you want to define a Hamiltonian flow, what you want to do is keep locality. You want to kind of keep that it's only let's say, 4 neighbor interactions, but instead of a 2-level system, you might want to kind of work with a 10-level system or a 20-level system, and that might kind of go to a fixed point. And that's a very conceptually a very different kind of thing than the original kind of flow of Wilson, in which you kind of really have a Hamiltonian and you kind of just vary the parameters of your Hamiltonian, but you keep the same Hilbert space. What you do here is basically change the space on which you act up to some point, and then somehow you get a fixed point in some kind of representation. Yes?
So if you say that with this TNR, like you can build meras with this thing, right? Like you can build up a mera by doing a TNR.
Yes.
But a mera gives you an RG of Hamiltonians, no? And there everything stays positive and is interpretable as an effective Hamiltonian.
It's a quantum Hamiltonian. He's talking about the classical.
This is all about classical StatMech, you know, and there's no interpretation in terms of a Hamiltonian flow like yeah. Anyway, so what we did is add this tiny plus to this TNR. And so this is a scheme which produces similar results, but preserves positivity. Okay, and it was actually fun to do this because we had to invent lots of new linear algebra kind of tricks to get this to work. But at the end, so at least we have now a Hamiltonian flow. We can really kind of see a Hamiltonian, how it flows towards somehow a fixed point. And as I already said, so what the whole point is that it remains a completely local Hamiltonian, but somehow where the spins might actually be of larger dimensions. What comes out of this algorithm is actually that the Hamiltonian is typically not, so these tensors are not strictly positive. There's lots of zeros. But these zeros is not a problem, of course, from the point of view of a classical StatMech model. These are kind of systems with constraints. Okay, so like if you look at the 6-vertex model or the 8-vertex model of Baxter, there's also lots of zeros in this partition function. It just means that indeed there's a constraint. If this spin is up, then this one has to be up too, and so further. So this is basically, you get still kind of a nice interpretation in terms of StatMech problems. And somehow the scheme seems to actually be pretty stable, and we don't need any tricks actually to get it to work. So it's, in that sense, really, you can really use this as a black box. The only kind of thing that you need is this new tool, and I don't think that anybody of you has ever heard of this, but this is actually called non-negative matrix factorization. So if you look at TRG, TNR schemes, they are completely built on a singular value decomposition. What you do is kind of do the singular value decomposition on and on again. And the problem with the singular value decomposition is you have a matrix, right, that has a unitary times a diagonal times a unitary. Well, the unitary, for a unitary to be non-trivial, it must have indeed negative coefficients or a complex coefficients, okay? Because otherwise you cannot have any interest in unitaries. So the non-negative matrix factorization is somehow you would like to factorize, let's say, a matrix and an n by n, somehow you would like to represent this as a product of 2 low-rank matrices. Okay, so this is basically what the SVD problem solves in an optimal way. This is the way you can even define in a variational way what the singular value decomposition is. You say, look, I have a matrix and I want to approximate it as good as I can by a product of 2 kind of matrices that are very sparse in the sense they're low rank. And the best way of doing this is typically the singular value decomposition. Well, what we do here is actually require that X and Y are both elements-wise non-negative matrices. Okay, so what you have to do is basically come up with algorithms that are able to do that. Given a tensor, split this tensor up into a product of tensors that are kind of have a low bond dimension between them, such that this kind of thing is still positive. It turns out that actually this non-negative matrix factorization is pretty popular in the machine learning community, and that's why somehow good algorithms have been developed in recent years. For this. So unlike the SVD, actually, in principle, this problem is NP-hard. So finding the optimal kind of non-negative matrix factorization of a certain rank for a given matrix is actually a hard problem. But in practice, that doesn't seem to be a problem. In practice, these things work very well. So when I just to give you an idea of what somehow this machine learning kind of, why this is kind of very useful in terms of machine learning. So I just did an example. I don't think they use this for this at all, but this is kind of, I just wanted to try. You have the kind of this huge database with all kind of possible digits that you have to recognize. And this is like a typical hard machine learning problem that is typically kind of supervised. You kind of get lots of digits and you have to kind of come up with a neural network that kind of is able to do this. But just to give you an idea of the power of this non-negative matrix factorization and why non-negative is kind of of crucial in getting these kind of things to work. It's indeed somehow I give you, let's say, this matrix that you can download. It's like 42,000 digits between 0 and 9. And they all have, like, they basically kind of all form a 785 matrix. Okay, this is like, for example, the tree that you will see what this kind of thing means. But somehow you have this matrix with all these digits. And let's try to actually do much more than what they kind of. So what they have is that they have a list they have kind of attached to this. This is a 1, this is a 2, and then kind of train your set to do this. What you want is indeed that this matrix, which contains just kind of digits, this is like a value 10, this is 0, if there's nothing, this is a 0, if this is kind of yellow, it's a value 10, and so further. So there's no meaning in indeed somehow such matrices with negative coefficients. And what you want is that if you have this huge matrix, you want to approximate this, you want to compress this huge matrix in such a way that you can basically identify what are the typical kind of digits in this thing. So I just run this kind of algorithms to this. You have this thing, I did this morning, so it's very easy. So you kind of ask, okay, let me try to find the 10 most kind of let me try to find the rank 10 approximation to this matrix. Because somehow what you expect is, indeed, I have all these digits from 0 to 9, that somehow this non-negative matrix factorization will be able to kind of capture basically the effective, the real kind of 9 different digits. Okay, so, and why is it important that it's non-negative? It's because you don't want these pictures to be superpositions of kind of things with negative weights. You want actually that this algorithm finds indeed somehow lots of columns with 1s, with 2s, with 3s, and this is a typical vector that you get indeed by doing this. You have this A, all these digits, you kind of plot just this, you ask for 10 vectors, a rank 10 approximation, and you kind of plot then one of these vectors Y, and what comes out is exactly a beautiful tree. Okay, so this means that indeed this is what happens. No? You get something positive, because somehow pictures, it doesn't make sense to kind of superpose pictures with negative coefficients, and that's the typical kind of case. But anyway, this is just a toy.
Can you use this stochastic MPS to do...
Yes. Of course, this is exactly what you need for stochastic MPS. And what you will see is that indeed, in these algorithms, instead of having unitary MERAS, what will come out is actually stochastic MERAS that you can also deal with efficiently. Okay, so anyway, so the way we set this up is indeed very similar to the two approaches actually it's closer to the approach of Shuo, because somehow this is exactly what is suited. We don't want to work with unitaries, disentanglers, all this. This doesn't exist, of course, in a positive world. So what we have is this kind of plaquette, and we approximate, so we change the tensor product structure. It's always the same kind of thing. So you have this thing, well, you change the tensor product structure, because that was actually really the key in getting all these algorithms to work. And this is actually, you can just use this algorithms that I just talked about, this generalization of these SVDs. And you do this, and you kind of find these non-negative matrices that approximate kind of these loops at every step. Okay, and the non-negative constraints typically lead to sparse solutions. That typically there's lots and lots of zeros that pop up there, okay? Because you want these matrices to be elements-wise non-negative. Well, then there's lots of zeros, because somehow your optimal solution is typically lying on the border of your system, which is good, because these zeros have always a very clear meaning. Now, it means that indeed the classical statistical mechanical model that you have has lots of constraints and so further. Okay, so how does the scheme work? Well, actually, it's very simple. It's even simpler than the other ones, no? Because you have this, you approximate it with this, you replace somehow these tensors now, you place everywhere you have this with these tensors. And now you have to be careful, actually, to block in the right way. There's two ways of blocking this thing now to this set. And you have to be very careful in blocking this thing in the right way, because there's one good way, and this is like the blue way is the good way, the red way is the bad way of blocking. And you can, of course, trace this back to this kind of double loop problem. If you don't block in the right way, you can. And then somehow you get randomization fixed points, and you can play all the games that have been played by TNR people, and it works equally well, which is kind of surprising, because you think that without an SVD this doesn't work. So these are kind of the numerical results. We did somehow the Ising, the critical Ising Hamiltonian, but also like in the classical, of course, or also spin ice, which is a more kind of complicated model. This is like one of these six vertex models that has to do with, well, for which actually the results are also known, because this is a better ansatz solvable model, and you kind of do the calculations. You extract critical exponents and scaling dimensions, just like you actually do in the usual TNR, and the accuracy of the exponents that you get is very, very similar. somehow the way we calculate, I didn't explain how we calculate this critical exponents. Actually, the way we calculate this critical exponents is by indeed using this radial kind of transfer matrix, very similar to what Giffrey and Glenn kind of did using this conformal transformation. But somehow in this setting, this gives you a very natural kind of framework. Okay, if you're kind of using these green things, it's very natural. So what you're interested in is indeed eigenvectors or eigenvalues of such kind of objects. So the nice thing actually of this whole approach is that it's a really simple kind of relations, and somehow what determines a fixed point is a simple set of algebraic relations. So if you want to find what are all the possible fixed points of this kind of method, you have to solve basically these two problems. Find all the blue tensors and the green tensors, so that this is equal to this and this is equal to this. And if you find solutions of these algebraic equations, then you have a fixed point. Is it possible to find all solutions? I don't know. If we let the dimension d go to infinity, somehow this problem should, in some sense, be equivalent to classifying all possible CFTs, okay? Because we know that CFTs would have to kind of have this scale invariance. So somehow, can we recognize somehow something like of the CFT structure in this? Maybe, or maybe not. We don't know.
Sorry, but these are only the CFTs that come from the statistical model.
Yes, sure.
So, I mean, generally a quantum system.
Just like in the normal TNR, you get Mira. What you get here is actually, if you follow exactly the same scheme, what you get is that the fixed point of your transfer matrix is actually a stochastic Mira. So a stochastic Mira is a Mira where all the matrices are actually positive matrices. So they are basically stochastic matrices mapping probability distributions to probability distributions. And somehow the norm that you want to use in such systems is, of course, not the two norm, but the one norm. And therefore, somehow, what you want to do if you calculate expectation value is not take the overlap of that Mira with itself, but actually with all pluses, with just the product state. And because this is stochastic matrix, you can actually deal with all these kind of things, and this works very well. So this is also very nice that indeed, what this gives you is actually a stochastic Mira as a fixed point for the transfer matrices of classical StatMech models. Okay, so now in the remaining, how many minutes do we have?
One.
Anyway, so what is important if you kind of do this in practice is to keep the symmetries, okay? But that's very clear. If you do an RG transformation, an RG, whatever, a Hamiltonian flow, you really have to keep the symmetries of your problem. This was already well known by Wilson, by everybody. And indeed, somehow, what I would like to talk about briefly at the end of this talk is indeed how to kind of take this into account, how to kind of keep the symmetries in the problem, and what kind of structure do you get by doing this. Okay, and typical symmetries, like if you have the Ising model, the typical symmetries are like this. Now I have this kind of tensor corresponding to the classical Ising model. Well, if I put two poly X matrices there, this is equal to kind of putting two X matrices there. Okay, so this is like the typical symmetry that you have to preserve at every step. Of course, after a decimation step in a higher level, this X will not just be a poly matrix with level 2 anymore. It might be a 10-level system or whatever, but there will be kind of still form a representation of your Z2 symmetry. Now, what is fascinating is that actually in these tensor network descriptions is that at criticality, you get typically much more richer. Only at criticality, it turns out that there's a much richer class of symmetries that emerge. Okay, so namely, these are not symmetries like you apply here an A and a B and this is a B and an A. No, you need somehow these symmetries to be represented by matrix product operators. Okay, so you need somehow the symmetries are much kind of more intricate. It means that actually this thing and this thing, if you pull this kind of thing through your tensor, then this is a symmetry. But this is not as simple. This is correlated to this, and this is correlated to what happens otherwise. And then you see that you get indeed somehow Wilson loop type objects that you can pull through your lattice. It turns out that this kind of new symmetries that arise exactly at criticality are crucial in getting these schemes to work and getting indeed somehow also this algebraic content of somehow your CFTs out. Okay, so I think this is a pretty amazing kind of thing, that indeed at criticality there's new kind of symmetries that emerge, but the amazing thing is that these symmetries can be represented very concisely by very small matrix product operators. Okay, so the fact somehow such symmetries have been kind of discovered and independently by many kind of works in these tensor networks. So we were mainly kind of working on this already like for a few years because this is crucial in being able to represent topological systems. Okay, systems that have anionic excitations and all this in quantum case. Well, this is exactly what we need. We need somehow these matrix product operator symmetries, and this is a necessary ingredient to have systems with topological order. But this same kind of symmetries, but not in this language. I don't think that somehow they are not kind of phrased in terms of matrix product operators, but effectively they are the same. Somehow appear in kind of these other works, like this work in the group of Giffre, together with many people here in PI, but also somehow some very nice kind of papers of David Aysen, Roger Mong, and Paul Fendley. Somehow this, where indeed somehow these new symmetries, these emerging symmetries at criticality are basically identified and connected to somehow the CFT kind of things that occur. So let me kind of give you an example of the Ising model. So if you have the classical Ising model at criticality, so basically the transfer matrix, okay, so this one row in your kind of tensor network is nothing more than this. So this is a G at Z basically. So this thing, this index is your spin. This, if this is a one, it's a one everywhere. If it's a zero, it's a zero everywhere. And this red dot is nothing more than e to the beta, e to the minus beta, e to the minus beta, e to the beta. It's basically giving you, it takes you 2 minutes to understand that indeed, if you kind of contact, you kind of take this whole tensor network, you stack these kind of things onto each other, that this is indeed the partition function of the classical Ising model. Now, the amazing thing is that exactly at but only at criticality, there's a new symmetry that arises. Okay? And this symmetry is kind of represented by a matrix product operator that is of that kind of form. So this white thing consists out of two blocks here. This is like a Hadamard matrix, and one of exactly the same red dots that is equal to this. Okay? And exactly at criticality, somehow this matrix product operator commutes with your transfer matrix. And therefore, it's kind of a new symmetry that arises. Okay, so there's other matrix product operator symmetries, obviously, that commute with your transfer matrix. Okay, for example, the X tensor N, this is this trivial symmetry that is there everywhere, independent of your temperature, but also, for example, the shift operator. Okay, you have a transfer matrix. Well, it commutes with the shift operator because you have a translation invariant transfer matrix. Shifting it is also a kind of a symmetry. So basically, these are all the symmetries that you have. You have like a matrix product. You can all represent them as matrix product operators. You have indeed this non-trivial symmetry, and this actually corresponds to somehow the duality defect. And this is why this is very much related to somehow these other papers that I mentioned about. But you also have the shift operator and the transfer matrix. And this forms basically the complete set of symmetries of your transfer matrix. And if you have a complete set of symmetries, then of course they should kind of form an algebra. Because if I have symmetries and I multiply these things with each other, I should get a new symmetry. And therefore, I should be able to kind of express them in terms of kind of algebraic relation between each other. And indeed, if you do this, somehow what you see is that, for example, this psi times, this psi is this x kind of thing. No? So this sigma was this non-trivial duality defect, that psi times sigma is equal to psi. No? Psi squared is the identity. And this is the most interesting one, of course, is that if you take this duality defect squared, you get 1 plus psi times somehow the shift in one direction times the transfer matrix. So what does that mean is actually this, why do we get this? So this is kind of very clear. Everybody recognizes the Ising CFT. No? These are actually really the rules of indeed kind of sigma times sigma is equal to one plus psi. These are like, this is the operator content. But somehow on this lattice version and this matrix product operator version, what you get is also this kind of S and T. And this is really clear because this duality defect is basically mapping your lattice to the dual lattice. And if you do this twice, you have shifted basically your whole system one side up or one side down and to the right. And indeed, the shift operator is basically the translation operator in one direction. It's kind of, as far as I understand, in the CFT language, this is like the L0 plus L0 dagger. And somehow, or L0 bar. And the T is basically the shift in the vertical direction, which is actually L0 minus L0 bar, or the opposite. I'm not so sure about how you kind of calculate it. But this is just the transfer matrix, indeed, the shift in the other direction. And then you say, now I have kind of this algebraic relation. So all these matrix product operators must form a closed algebra. And indeed, somehow, you get a very simple kind of algebra for these matrix product operators that indeed represent the symmetries in these tensor networks. Okay, so this is again somehow just the same thing. So we clearly observe, of course, the fusion rules for the Ising CFT. Okay, so and the question is now, what is the meaning of these kind of of these operators? What is the meaning of these matrix product operators? Are they in what way are they related to the primary fields in your system or not? And actually, this it's clear that this cannot be the primary fields or something of your original theory, because somehow this is really this fusion rules that you get here are for the chiral theory. And we have a lattice system here, so we should really kind of get the chiral and the anti-chiral part. So how do we get out of somehow this whole business, this matrix product operator algebra, how do we get now actually the real content of your CFT on the lattice, namely the chiral and the anti-chiral part? And indeed somehow these matrix product operators are somehow from the point of view of topological order, if you kind of are familiar with this is like the input category in your system. And somehow the CFT, the real kind of operator content or the real kind of CFT on the lattice will kind of be the Drint-filled kind of center of that input category and will give rise to somehow the string net. So it's the equivalent of basically calculating or constructing the string net from some input category. So what this is, these symmetries of your system give you some kind of an input category, and now you have to build somehow from this kind of, well, from this tensor fusion category point of view, you have to build some kind of a doubled version out of this, and this will represent somehow the operator content or somehow the full CFT content, or the algebraic part of your CFT content of your system. And indeed, somehow, you have to do this. Actually, if you want to do this kind of calculation in the right way, you have to identify, you have to understand all these kind of symmetries. And indeed, somehow, these matrix, you have to understand how to pull basically these matrix product operators from one level of your RG to the next level of your RG if you want to kind of do these things carefully. And in a very recent nice paper of Bridgman and Williamson, they exactly did this. No? Dominic Williamson is one of my students. So they indeed looked at somehow these matrix product operator symmetries that arise and somehow these topological models, and they kind of built somehow MERA for the fixed points of these transfer matrices, and they were able to build this MERA in such a way that automatically this kind of matrix product operator symmetry is kind of encoded. What are the natural questions now? So it's clear that somehow constructing closed algebras of matrix product operators must be extremely kind of closely related now to calculating or constructing all possible CFTs. Okay, so can we do that? How can we kind of construct all these matrix product operator algebras in general? Or how are somehow these related to the classification of all possible CFTs? And how do we actually extract conformal data from those matrix product operator algebras? And this is, of course, very much related to these papers of Kifre and of David Eisen and company. So, and do I have time left, or I have to stop?
We have a minute.
Sorry?
I mean, we started a bit late, so you have a minute to do that.
2 minutes, yes, okay. So what we had done in these previous papers, actually, and what we had in mind was really kind of constructing matrix product operator algebras, because somehow for representing anionic theories and relate them to topological quantum field theories. But it turns out that exactly the same technology that we developed for this whole TQFT thing is, of course, equivalent to somehow what you want to do for CFTs, for somehow these tensor networks that I talked before. So what you're interested in is basically constructing all possible closed algebras of matrix product operators. So typically, if you have a matrix product operator times another one, and this is equal to somehow the third one, this would be like in the group case, then somehow there is something that is extremely powerful, and this is called the fundamental theorem of matrix product states. It means that if two matrix product states are equal to each other, there must exist some kind of a gauge transform that transforms one into the other one. Again, it means that there exists something like an X, a fusion tensor, that takes two of these tensors, and basically if you pull this through, somehow you map somehow this lambda and a mu, you get a lambda mu. So this is how this kind of works. No? You take an X, come from left, and we can prove that this has to be true. So if you have a closed algebra of matrix product operators, there must exist such an object X that kind of satisfies this. Okay, and what is nice is, of course, if such an object exists, it has to satisfy some associativity. Because if I have like the product of three matrix product operators, I can first kind of take with this and then this one, or I can first take these two and then this one, and they have to satisfy some associativity conditions. And this basically leads to somehow the whole business of tensor fusion categories. So just trying to understand how can I systematically build up all possible matrix product operator algebras that are closed, you immediately arrive at something that is called tensor fusion category. And so what we did in these papers is basically do this in a systematic way. Constructed all possible matrix product operators that satisfy closed algebra. You get these fusion tensors. What you get is these F symbols, there's lots of technical details. You get the Pentagon equation. And then somehow at the end, you do all these kind of things, and you see, well, at the end, this fusion tensor are completely fixed, but there's only a finite number of possible ways in which this can happen. And this is exactly kind of given by solutions of these Pentagon equations. And once you have these solutions, you can actually construct the matrix product operators themselves in a very similar way as you do in the beta ansatz. In the beta ansatz, you actually construct solutions for the R matrices, and then when you find this solution of the R matrices, you know how to construct transfer matrices starting from these R matrices. This is a fundamental kind of representation, and you can actually play all the same games here. It's very much related actually to what people do in beta ansatz. Okay, so this means that indeed, so this allows you to construct in a systematic way matrix product operator algebras, but that's not solved yet the problem of finding basically the primary fields and all these kind of things that will live in this thing. This only kind of basically encodes the symmetries of this of the partition function, but we still have to find out what the primary fields are in our kind of lattice version of the system. So to obtain this, what we need to do is basically take one of these strings and put an endpoint to this string. Okay, so because this is exactly what these primary fields are, they will be kind of some objects that are kind of localized. These are kind of local fields that will have kind of one of these strings attached to them that you can basically pull through your lattice. And the question is, can you build up such kind of objects that satisfy these kind of things? And this is exactly somehow exactly the same language, this whole tensor fusion category. You see that there's actually a quasi-unique way of obtaining this. So what you have to do at the end, the endpoint of such a string has to be of some form where somehow these fusion tensors again kind of arise. And what you see is that actually objects like this, they actually seem to form some kind of a Z-star algebra. It means that, so in this case, for example, you have five indices on the outside. This would be where the string comes in. Okay, this is the string comes in. And this is defining some topological sector. And you have five indices on the outside. You have five indices on the inside. So you can multiply objects like that with each other. And what you can easily see is that they form a closed kind of algebra, a C-star algebra again. And somehow, then it turns out that actually all these different primary fields correspond to somehow the central idempotents of this algebra. So you can do this. So we did this. If you do this, for example, for the Ising case, this is what we did in this paper. You can kind of go through the case. You start from basically your input category. You get indeed these F symbols, and you calculate these idempotents. As you see, that somehow you get 9 idempotents. Okay. And the question is now, what does that mean? What is the meaning of somehow these idempotents in terms of indeed the Ising CFT on the lattice? Now, there's a very nice trick. Once you have somehow this whole structure of these matrix product operators and somehow this idempotents, what you can actually kind of look at is, for example, the topological spin. So what you take is one of these objects and say, well, what would be the spin of such kind of an anion, an endpoint of something like that? Well, it would be basically, I would be able to calculate what the spin is by rotating this thing over 360 degrees. So rotating this thing over 360 degrees just means put this MPO around it, okay? Because that's what you would get if you rotate your spin. And by using all these rules, you can see that this is nothing more than the original object up to a phase. And you can calculate this phase for all these different idempotents. And somehow what you see is that somehow all these phases, these H's are basically these phis. So you get this 1 over 16 and all these kind of things. Exactly, of course, the topological or conformal spins that are supposed to be there in somehow your kind of T and your CFT. And that using this, of course, it's easy now to kind of associate these 9 idempotents to the primary fields of your full system. Okay, this gives you, for example, a trivial one, the sigma, sigma bar, psi, sigma, and so forth. So this gives you somehow the full kind of operator, all the primary fields, basically, without ever having done any calculation, basically, in the critical system. Now, so this is purely obtained by starting from these symmetries, these matrix product operator symmetries, which are very simple, and kind of looking at the consequences of what does it mean if I have a closed algebra of these symmetries. All these objects, all these idempotents are just kind of completely determined by these original symmetries. So you don't have to know any kind of the CFT or of the conformal kind of symmetries in your lattice. All these kind of objects or these properties are completely kind of determined by somehow the symmetries of your system, not. So what we cannot get out of these kind of things is, of course, the scaling exponents. For getting scaling exponents, we will have to kind of simulate these systems and kind of find fixed points and all this. But at least somehow all these things like top conformal spins, what somehow your fusion rules are, what operator products, the OPEs and all this, this is all kind of obtained. So, and why is this if you kind of would have one of these idempotents, I have another one, you ask, how can they fuse? Well, you just put another of these idempotents around it and see basically expand the product of these two and these kind of things. And this immediately gives you somehow this whole OPE kind of expansion. So somehow if I have one defect, I have another one, I combine them. What is somehow the new defect? And this immediately gives rise to all these OPEs. All of these kind of things are completely included there. Braiding, like this is the way we understood this in terms of these topological phases. But of course, also here in the CFT kind of context, I have like one defect that ends here, and I have another kind of thing that lives far away, but it has attached to it one of these symmetries, one of these kind of matrix product operators. I pull this kind of thing through, and you get indeed somehow this braiding matrix, this R, which turns out to be completely determined by exactly the same central idempotence. And out of this, of course, you immediately get somehow all the S matrices, the T matrices. All of this information is completely there in somehow this symmetries of the system. So let's kind of briefly summarize somehow what we did here. So we started from somehow a matrix product operator representation of somehow a model of an input tensor category. So this we started from somehow a representation in terms of matrix product operators of the symmetries of my lattice system, okay, for this kind of lattice system. And out of this, we constructed, in technical terms, somehow some kind of a Drinfield center of this category. And this gives you the doubled problem. So this gives you indeed the chiral and anti-chiral part of this input category. And this is indeed somehow the CFT content of your full theory. So using this approach, so of course, well, this it's a very involved thing, but it's completely general and it works in general. Somehow, this seems to be similar or the same as what other people have done in a completely different language. But it seems that somehow these approaches, these different papers actually are very, very much related to indeed constructing somehow all possible topological conformal defects is exactly identifying all these idempotents in your kind of algebra. So I will conclude here. Real space RG, you have Kadanov, you have TRG, TNR, and TNR plus, and then you have symmetries. Thanks. Yes.
So, what I thought you might have different categories with the same F matrix but different spins. Because I can have different braiding R matrix. So I'm not sure when you get the spin, do you input something other than the F symbol?
No, this is completely determined by the F symbol. Oh, sorry. Well, there's of course. Yeah, let me try to go back here. Actually, you need this kind of basically the fusion rules. A, B goes to C. This is this input category.
Yeah.
That this is basically, and then you have the F symbols, and then somehow there's this this kappa, which is basically some Frobenius indicator, and you need this kind of triple of information, and that completely determines the topological spin.
Like we know there are these. Different icing CFTs with different topological
TQFTs
with the icing fusion rule, but the spin can be
1/16
times.
No, but for a given NABC, there might be different F symbols. Okay, so it's just we know that there's a finite number of solutions for a given time of, but there might be different solutions of the pentagon equations. And I suspect that what you talk about is that actually you get different solutions for the F symbols. So the pentagon equation might have completely different solutions that have nothing to do with each other. Like if you take the simplest case, the Z2, like the case of the toric code, this is like a completely trivial thing. Well, there's for a Z2 kind of theory, we have two solutions of the F symbols. You have the toric code and you have the double semion. Again, this is how you kind of get all the possible different ways in which this topological order can be realized. And I suspect that somehow this is also, of course, I'm not a specialist in CFTs, but that this is exactly also how you can understand many of the of the CFTs. And again, I think this formalism that we explained here go beyond certainly the classical case. This is also true for quantum kind of, this should also kind of be true for quantum for quantum CFTs. But I don't know to what extent this is general or not general, or we miss something, or we, maybe there's something new there. This is completely open. Yes.
You show this like commentary from Kadanov, and I interpreted that as saying you wanted to see like some flow of Hamiltonians, but I don't think you actually showed that. Is there some insight from the TNR plus? Like, is there a nice picture? Or, like, a structure fixed point Hamiltonian?
Yeah, in the paper we have a picture where we basically plot a fixed point Hamiltonian, and you can see that indeed many of the elements are zero and some kind of, well, you can start playing indeed and trying to understand basically what happens. And indeed this thing is connected with this, and this is an important part in your Hamiltonian, this is not important, and so far you can start playing this game, but we have not completely exploited this. But we have indeed a fixed point Hamiltonian, okay? And it should be indeed, would be very interesting to study this and try to give this thing an interpretation. At least we can, at least we have a fixed point Hamiltonian here, a classical Stat-Mech model that is probably like, within somehow the approximations, of course, of this TNR scheme, is really a fixed point of these equations. So it's really, this is, but of course, so this will never be the full theory, you know? Even in a TNR setting, just like in a Mera, you cannot completely capture the full kind of tower of all your descendants because the bond dimension of, or the kind of Mera, just like the TNR, is limited. No? You can never get everything. You have to cut at some point. And this is the same thing here. So this is not, it's not because you have a fixed point that this is the exact solution of your CFT. No, it's just a fixed point within this scheme. So within this scheme, where you cut in this way, this is kind of a fixed point.
So the fusion rules you wrote down with sigma and psi and so on, you could have equally well called the psi and epsilon as far as those fusion rules are concerned, right? So epsilon is psi bar in the language of the operators in the IP.
So you mean? So these are basically the all the primaries, all the primary
flips.
The original ones.
The original ones, the three, okay. Yeah. The input category in some sense.
So I assume the reason you're writing the psi is because you have this interpretation, this thing, which is coming from this MPO algebra.
Indeed. So this is indeed a very nice thing. Now the fact that this matrix product operator that is kind of correlated to the duality effect is actually something that includes a shift. So it means it is really a chiral object. So the input is chiral, and therefore this cannot be the whole story. But it also limits, and I would be, well, we should try to understand somehow your talk within the light of these symmetries. All the eigenvectors of this transfer matrix should kind of also be eigenvectors of this non-trivial half-shift operator. Because if you apply this operator twice, you shift over one side. So there's something very non-trivial there. There's a half-shift. It's like a Majorana type of thing that changes indeed the order of the Majorana modes, and somehow it would be very interesting to understand this better. Indeed. Yes.
Yeah.
And this, but here we have an explicit MPO kind of representation of that thing within the lattice. It's really as a symmetry. So we don't look at this as a defect line. No, this is really a symmetry of our kind of our partition function. And actually, because of the symmetry, it's that we had to associate, actually attach this red dot. That's what kind of gave rise to some complications. But yeah, that's what comes out. No, this is.
Isn't it that if you put a defect in, you can move it around freely? I mean, that's where the symmetry is, right?
No, I think the interpretation of the way we look at it is different than the interpretation you would give to a Cramer's one, to this duality. Now, for us, this is not a duality, it's just a symmetry. This is nothing more than a matrix product operator symmetry in your lattice.
Right.
Now, what they become physical, these kind of things, when you attach somehow a field at the end. And and there's nine different topological sectors in which you can kind of attach, indeed, somehow objects at the end of such strings. And these are basically the primary. All these primary fields.
Okay, there are no further questions. Let's thank Frank again.